Good afternoon. Illinois Appellate Court, First District Court is now in session. The First Division, the Honorable Justice Michael B. Hyman presiding. Case number 21-0833, Heather Williams versus Robert Sylvester Kelly.
Good afternoon. My name is Justice Michael Hyman. With me is Justice Carl Anthony Walker and Justice Mary Ellen Coghlan. We are going to conduct the hearing as if we were in the courtroom, in that we will interrupt you probably and ask you questions. If you would finish whatever you're saying and then respond to the questions, we'd appreciate it. Each side has 20 minutes. When you introduce yourself, the appellant, will you please indicate how many minutes you wish for rebuttal?
Good afternoon, justices, and good afternoon, counsel. I am Mark Zito, counsel for defendant appellant Robert Sylvester Kelly, and I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. Mrs. Deutschman.
Good afternoon. My name is Jeff Deutschman. I represent the appellee, in this case. We'll probably be taking anywhere between 10 and 15 minutes for our argument.
Okay, you get 20 minutes, so.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Any questions before we begin? Hearing none, Mr. Zito.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. In this appeal, Mr. Kelly sets forth three issues for the court's consideration. Ms. Williams only addresses one of those issues in her brief, which is whether the trial court abused its discretion in denying the petition where it pleaded sufficient facts to grant Mr. Kelly relief under Section 214.01. The two issues Ms. Williams fails to address in her brief are, one, whether the trial court abused its discretion when it failed to use its equitable powers to prevent the unjust enforcement of the default judgment by granting the petition, and two, whether the trial court committed reversible error when it failed.
Mr. Zito, do you agree that the only standard of review that applies to all the issues in this case is abuse of discretion?
No, I don't, Justice Walker. I believe that it's abuse of discretion for one of the issues, the one that Ms. Williams responded to, and then the other issue with respect to the court using its equitable powers to prevent the unjust enforcement. The other one is reversible error. I don't believe that that is abuse of discretion standard. I believe that's de novo.
Thank you.
So the two issues that Ms. Williams did not respond to has the effect of conceding them, according to the court in Vukusich versus Comprehensive Accounting Corporation. As the court in Ploy v. Pariani, a First District court, stated, when an appellee does not address arguments in her brief, her position—
We know what the law is on that issue. Okay, Your Honor. Why are those arguments even relevant here?
Well, I didn't know if they would be, Your Honor. I was hoping—
I'm asking you, why do you believe they're relevant?
I was only trying to point out to the court that I believe that they have been conceded. The court does
conceded or not. That's not my question. Is that tell me the relevance of those two issues to this appeal.
The relevance of those two issues to this appeal?
Yes.
Given the fact that they were not responded to, or just given
whatever argument, why? I mean, let's assume that we'll find out what they say, but we've read the briefs and we've read the record. So okay. With regard to those two arguments, whether they're conceded or not, you're saying those are relevant. Those are something we need to decide, right? And why do we need to decide those? Why does that have anything to do with this appeal of the 1401 denial?
Your Honor, there are two reasons for that, Your Honor. The first one is we believe that under Air Room, the court should have, in this case, used its equitable powers to not enforce the judgment by granting the petition, not allowing the enforcement.
Well, why should it use the equitable? I mean, that argument is one that's rarely ever considered by courts. As you know, it's extraordinary circumstances, right?
Yes,
I don't understand why would this be extraordinary? What's extraordinary about it?
Well, I think the fact that Mr. Kelly was incarcerated at the same time.
That happens. That's not extraordinary. People do get incarcerated frequently and have cases in court. That's not an excuse.
And Your Honor, I don't disagree with that at all. I think that the extraordinary circumstances of the pandemic, though, caused the situation at the MCC to be different than it otherwise would have been.
I'm just following that logic.
Yes.
Every case of somebody who was in the federal jail would be able to make that argument. Is that's what you're telling us? I mean, if we came down and agreed with you, we'd be opening the floodgates to anybody who was incarcerated during the period of the COVID actions closing the courts.
Well, I do think that it depending on the certain factual circumstances surrounding the entry of their judgments, they may have that argument as well, Your Honor.
How do we differentiate? You're saying it's extraordinary because of COVID, and here we know he knew about the what was going on. He received copies, he knows he has a responsibility on his own to check with what's going on. And you know, 11 months passed, and a lot of things happened here that had nothing to do with Mr. Kelly being incarcerated.
Well, Your Honor, I don't disagree that there that certainly there were mistakes by counsel and everything else. But as I know you're aware, the Arum case does say that the court should prevent an unjust, you know, enforcement of a default judgment here. This was a default judgment that was entered right as the pandemic blew up.
Are you saying that any time a judgment was entered right before the pandemic blew up, that becomes extraordinary? I mean, I'm trying to get to the crux of why this would be extraordinary. I mean, that's above and beyond the normal, because what we do here is an appellate court does have an effect on how others would respond with these circumstances that you've raised.
On the specific facts of this case, his counsel, you know, Mr. Kelly had been defending against the case until his counsel withdrew on January 28th. And counsel did not send an order was never sent.
Let me interrupt you right there. How does your argument jive with the fact that Mr. Kelly was able to get Mr. Nix to come in, be given leave to file an appearance, even more important to the facts of this case, be given leave to file a motion to vacate the default and then do nothing? So all these arguments about COVID-19 and he couldn't do this and he couldn't do that, you know, I'm sympathetic to those arguments, but it didn't stop him from somehow or other getting an attorney to come in and get leave of court to vacate this default.
My understanding, Your Honor, is that Mr. Greenberg, who was one of his criminal attorneys, was the one who was trying to deal with this and had dealt with Mr. Nix and Mr. Nix was going to come in as a friend and just try and provide a stopgap while Mr. Greenberg.
But our rules of the court do not support that argument that you're making. He, as an officer of the court, was given leave to file an appearance, which he did. He was given leave to file a motion to vacate, which he didn't do. He's an attorney licensed to practice in the state of Illinois.
I understand that, Your Honor. We made arguments based on the facts as we understood them in an attempt to try and get the judgment vacated. You'll note that we also made another argument, was that given all these different facts, that an evidentiary hearing should have been held by the trial court, and perhaps the trial court could have flushed some of this stuff out. And
why do you need an evidentiary hearing when a lawyer has been given leave to file a motion to vacate a default, which really is the heart of all of the issues here, and doesn't do it? Why do you need an evidentiary hearing for that?
Well, I think that we were asking for the evidentiary hearing for a number of different reasons, not just for that reason, but that there were disputed factual questions surrounding this, like with respect to whether the affirmative defense had been stricken. You know, because what happened here, Your Honor, was
that's a factual issue. I mean, whether it's stricken or not. I mean, isn't that in the record?
It's not a factual issue whether it was stricken. It's a factual issue whether it was stricken with prejudice. And I think if it wasn't stricken with prejudice, then it was not that's important because if the court were to vacate this, he would be able to then reassert that affirmative defense, depending on what the reasons were. It was never stricken on the merits.
Well, but again, that goes back to the fact that there's no bystander report, there's no transcript of the hearings, which falls on your shoulders, not you particularly, I'm just saying your side. Well, I'm not faulting you at all, please.
And Your Honor, let me respond to that. The reason that we don't have a transcript of the hearing on the petition, and we laid this out, is because there never was a hearing on the petition.
No, but but people who appeared before the judge with regard to the judge ruling on the affirmative defense. And my understanding is that an amended complaint was filed without any reference to the statute of limitations, right? Well, after, or maybe even the same day as they were before the judge, which leads one to believe that it was with prejudice, because if it wasn't, why would somebody not do that immediately? So is there any, again, why do we need a hearing?
A motion to reconsider was filed after that, and then it was never heard because Mr. Kelly's counsel withdrew. So the facts are basically what happened was Abdallah Law filed a motion for leave to file an answer, and then also filed an answer including the affirmative defense. And on that day, without a motion to strike being before the court, the court just sua sponte struck the affirmative defense. Which,
how do you know that?
Because we know that there was no pleading filed. So it couldn't have been stricken on the merits because there was no...
Again, how do we know that without a record? You're assuming, right?
Well, I don't think I am assuming, Your Honor. If there weren't pleadings filed attacking the affirmative defense as such, I don't see how it could have been stricken on the merits. And if it wasn't stricken on the merits...
Well, an oral motion have been brought? I mean, you say sua sponte. It sounds as if like the judge brought it up. But, you know, that may not have been the case. It may have been, you know, nobody appeared. So it's always a dangerous thing when a lawyer...
No. Somebody was in court on that day. Abdallah Law was in court on that day. And okay, so...
Then they knew what was going on. And again, there's no transcript. So to say sua sponte, that's not something we can... How can we take account of that?
Well, and Your Honor, and I don't want to argue with you. We were only responding to the arguments that that counsel made in their response to our appeal, which was that we had the only argument that was made in the response was that we needed to have a transcript of the hearing on the petition, and the court never held one. So we didn't get into any of the other things because that wasn't an argument that was brought up on appeal. I mean, I understand that that the justices would like to understand that. Now, I haven't thought through all of it other than to say, we did lay out the facts as we understood them. And this is based on the pleadings that were filed, which were that nothing was filed attacking the affirmative defense. The affirmative defense was actually filed on the same day as the hearing on which it was stricken. So we know that it wasn't responded to by a pleading.
Mr. Zito, aren't these arguments more properly raised in a direct appeal? This is a situation where we're looking at a default judgment here. And of your arguments go to the merits of what should have happened had there not been a default, perhaps.
And Your Honor, would that have been an interlocutory appeal, as I understand it. And wouldn't the interlocutory appeal have had to have been such that it wouldn't just, the facts of this case, as I understand it, would not have been enough to allow an interlocutory appeal? It would have had to have a larger implications.
You know, I guess that I'm having trouble understanding how counsel's failure to file a motion to vacate the default is justified, and how any of your arguments really have any relevance based on that central failure to do what should have been done.
And Your Honor, I think we did address that somewhat. I don't know all the reasons that it wasn't, but I can say that we did.
Your best argument on that point.
Well, we argued and noted that Ms. Williams' counsel intimidated Mr. Nix and told him that he'd turn him into the ARDC if he filed
it. Is that
in
the record? Is that, I saw that in your brief. Is that in the record?
We have an affidavit to that effect, and then it's also in the brief. The affidavit was filed along with the
Affidavit's in the record.
The affidavit, yes, was filed with the reply in support of the petition, because that was when we got the affidavit for that, saying, well, this is why it took so long to file it.
Even if that's true, and I don't know what intimidation means under these circumstances, we're not talking about any kind of ARDC situation here, apparently. I mean, that's not for us to decide, but how, I don't see how that one has anything to do with the other.
What we argued based on Mr. Nix's affidavit is that he was intimidated by Ms. Williams' counsel, who threatened to report him to the ARDC if he filed anything on behalf of Mr. Kelly. And, you know, I think importantly, that was never responded to. They didn't address that. We don't have an affidavit from Ms. Williams' counsel saying that never happened. I mean, they don't.
Was that ever brought up before a court? The affidavit from Mr. Nix?
The affidavit? No, because there was never a hearing on the petition.
Right. So we don't know. I mean, all we have there, no hearing. So, I mean, we don't know anything about that.
We don't know anything other than that the petition was denied. So we have no idea what the findings of fact were by the trial court here. We don't know what the trial court.
It goes back to the fact that we don't have a transcript or a bystander report.
Yes.
There might be a reason why Mr. Nix didn't do what he was supposed to do, but I'm still having a problem figuring out how that has any bearing on the fact that it wasn't done.
Well, again, we made the
argument. This is the same Mr. Nix who filed contrary affidavits in the same motion.
Yes, Your Honor, and we did address that, that Mr. Nix had forgotten that he had been in court and filed two separate, he filed an appearance that day and also an order that Judge Lipscomb.
I'm sure you can appreciate how, you know, from where someone is sitting reading these, that raises somewhat of a red flag on the issue of credibility.
I don't disagree with that, Your Honor. Mr. Nix gave us the first affidavit and we filed the petition, you know, in part based on that. And then later on, when Ms. Williams responded and we realized that was incorrect, of course, we went back to him and he said, I completely forgot about that. But, you know, I don't know anything more than that. Since I don't know what Mr. Nix was thinking. But I think that.
Well, I agree with Justice Hyman and I'm sure my colleague, Justice Walker, no one is faulting you, but, you know, the facts are the facts here and we can't ignore them.
Yes. And I wouldn't expect the court to at all. I think that. Two things that we're arguing here are that with respect to all of that, Ms. Williams didn't respond to two of our issues. And this court has the ability, if it wants to reverse on that basis alone.
No, but that's what I was going through. And you've addressed one of those two issues that we've just been discussing for quite a bit. What about the second? Why is that even relevant here?
Well, the second issue, we think that an evidentiary hearing would allow the court to have explored the issues that were brought up in our reply and support, which were that Ms. Williams' counsel's intimidation tactics, because it seems like you guys have a real question as to why Mr. Nix did not file a motion to vacate after he was given leave in March. And I think that an evidentiary hearing would have allowed the court to explore that and to explore the fact that Ms. Williams' counsel intimidated him and said he would turn him into the ARDC.
But is that a basis? I mean, there isn't anything else, right? That Mr. Nix said, well, I was intimidated by a lawyer, so I didn't do it. Now, look, is that something that we can, in this case, would be reversible for not holding an evidentiary hearing, the fact that a lawyer has been accused by someone with whose credibility is in question with regard to a statement?
Well, in the Smith v. Airroom case, what the court said was that if a petition is filed and the facts in the petition are challenged by the uh, by the uh, by the respondent that the court should order an evidentiary.
Well, was there any challenge?
Yes. And we lay that out in our reply brief, and then our reply in support of the petition.
What was the challenge by Ms. Williams' counsel?
Ms. Williams' counsel, in the petition, Mr. Kelly argued that the affirmative defense was not stricken with prejudice. And the reason for that is because Ms. Williams had never responded in any way to the affirmative defense. The affirmative defense was filed on the day of the hearing on which it was stricken. There was no time to have a filed response. And so the court struck it. And so we thought that is a contested issue of fact. I mean,
because they didn't hear, just simply on the fact that there was no hearing. And what rule are you relying on to say that there should have been a hearing? Besides the case,
It's the Smith v. Irwin case.
I know it's a case, but I'm talking about any rule. What rule says? I mean, cases can be differentiated in various ways because of the case. But is there a rule that you're relying on, or a statute?
I'm not, Justice Hyman. I'm not aware of a rule or a statute that says that has to occur. What I'm relying on is Smith v. Irwin, which is, you know, the seminal case on this, that says if the respondent comes back and disputes facts in the petition, the court should hold an evidentiary hearing on those things. And the court didn't do it. And so we're saying that was reversible error. And that at a minimum, if the court's not prepared to reverse the trial court and grant the petition, that at a minimum, the court should reverse and remand to have that evidentiary hearing.
Any other questions at this time?
I've got a couple of questions. I guess the first thing is Mr. Zito, generally, there's really a rule requiring a court to hold an evidentiary hearing. It's just that when the court doesn't hold an evidentiary hearing, it will impact the standard of review that may be applied by this court, because there's no need to rely upon what the trial court did if they didn't make any factual findings. But I want to get to something else here. It's clear that the court denied the 26119, right?
Yes. That's,
and that issue is raised again in the 21401 petition, correct? As a meritorious defense.
Correct.
And the court basically takes the position that that's not a meritorious defense because the court has already ruled in the 2619 petition, correct?
Correct.
Okay, so where does that leave us now? Because the way I see it is that perhaps the issue regarding the court's 2619 ruling is still before this court. Because if this court doesn't review that issue now, when is that issue ever reviewed? So I want to hear your response to that.
Well, and Your Honor, I believe a motion to reconsider was filed on that issue, like later on, but then counsel withdrew. And that's what we're arguing, is that Mr. Kelly was unable to get counsel in there to deal with this. And so the judgment was entered in between. So the judgment was entered.
Right, but that has nothing to, I agree with you. Yeah. I agree with you, but that has nothing to do with what I'm saying, because what I'm, the denial of a 2619 petition, as you stated earlier, is not appealable anyway. The granting of that petition would be appealable. So in this case, it's not appealable. So that issue still remains, and that's an issue before this court right now. So I want to hear your response to that.
I think what you're asking me is you want to hear my response. You want me to explain.
Respond to my comment that that's an issue before this court right now.
Yes, I think it is, because it was never adjudicated. The motion to reconsider was never adjudicated.
Okay. And also, we realized that was not an appealable order. And then you did raise it again in your 21401 petition. Basically, it's you're arguing the same thing. The statute of limitations is an issue here in this case. Is that correct?
Yes. Well, as part of the 21401 petition, as your Honor knows, you need to set forth a meritorious defense. And so we set forth what we believe is a meritorious defense based on the statute of limitations.
Right, but the appellee is arguing, that's one of their arguments, is that you did not raise a meritorious defense. And they're using circular argument, in my opinion, by saying that you can't raise it because it's already been denied by the trial court.
Right, and what we are saying is that procedurally, what happened was they raised, Abdallah Law raised the issue of the statute of limitations in a motion in the 2619.1 motion to dismiss, which the court then denied. Then there was a motion to reconsider that pending, I believe. But what happened was in the meantime, a motion that motion to reconsider was actually filed later after the affirmative defenses were after the affirmative defense was filed along with the answer, and then the court struck that. But that was not, but the affirmative defense was not stricken because of a motion to strike it. It was just stricken by the court. It couldn't have been stricken by any motion because there was no motion before the court when it was stricken. And so from a procedural standpoint, I think what we were trying to say, Your Honor, is that they never responded substantively to the statute of limitations argument that we made in the petition at all. All they said was, it doesn't matter because it was stricken with prejudice. They don't actually make any argument substantively with respect to whether or not we were correct.
And you were asked earlier about the court, and you and that at that moment you were referring to the trial court not using its equitable powers. And I assume your argument is that that same issue of whether or not this court chooses to use equitable powers, but we're talking about a situation here where we all agree that generally speaking, our Supreme Court prefers that cases be decided on the merits rather than through some form of default, especially where a party is involved or at least attempting to be involved. This is a situation where Mr. Kelly was incarcerated at the time. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah.
And at the time, this was also the height of the pandemic. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
And well, it's right at the beginning of the pandemic, but there was, as everybody knows, there was.
Yeah, which more so things were even closed down more so at the beginning because no one knew where we were going or what was going on. But, okay. And then also, this is a situation where the Abdallah Law Firm, when they withdrew, it's my understanding that they never even sent Mr. Kelly a copy of the petition. Is that correct?
They never sent Mr.
Kelly. I'm sorry, of the order showing that they had withdrawn.
Yes, Justice. What happened was they had been in touch with Mr. Nix, who advised them that he was going to file an appearance to appear at the February 25th.
Yeah, but that's besides the point. Our court rules provide that when an attorney withdraws from a case, the attorney should forward a copy of that withdrawal order to the party so that they have 21 days to get counsel.
Yeah.
Isn't that correct?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And
that didn't happen. And that didn't happen in this case. Is that correct?
That's correct. And we acknowledge that.
I'm just trying to make sure we've got the facts right as we go forward in this thing.
We acknowledge that in our petition.
Okay. All right. And so then subsequent to that, Mr. Nix was working with Mr. Kelly. And it's my understanding that the only way that Mr. Kelly could communicate with his lawyers was if they were to accept a collect call from him. Is that correct?
That's my understanding as well, is that that civil attorneys were not able to, that no attorneys at the beginning of the pandemic were able to meet with clients.
This was the beginning of the pandemic. I thought it was further along, but you made it clear it was the very beginning.
Well, it was March 10th when the judgment was entered. So I think that they closed everything down maybe a week or two later. So completely down. And so during this time would have been the time they would have been trying to figure out what to do. But it was, Abdallah withdrew January 28th and then did not forward the order to Mr. Kelly. And then Mr. Nix didn't show up or didn't come to the hearing or file an appearance for the February 25th hearing. And then did not file an appearance until after the March 10th hearing where the default judgment was entered.
And then just tell us, what are you asking us to do today?
Well, what we're asking you to do is to reverse, based on the fact that we asked for two different kinds of relief. The first one was to vacate the judgment, you know, to reverse the trial court and vacate the judgment because Ms. Williams never responded to that argument. And then the other one was the other argument that Ms. Williams didn't respond to. The relief that we requested there was that the court find that it was reversible error and remand the case back to the trial court to hold an evidentiary hearing. So we gave the court two options under that. We felt that if the court were to reverse and to grant the petition, that that would, in fact, to your point, allow the court to hear the case on the merits, to adjudicate it on the merits, instead of on a default judgment.
Your motion to reconsider, what was new in that motion to reconsider?
Your Honor, I believe they just made the same arguments that they, and I'm not sure that there was anything new, but.
Thank you. All right, any other questions? Okay.
Nope.
You'll have your 5 minutes afterwards. Mr. Thank Deutsch.
Please, the court, counsel, I represent Ms. Williams here, who was as a 14-year-old abused by R. Kelly. She, in fact, is, I believe, testifying today against him.
Just a second. Well, that's important. He made a factual statement that's important. Was she 14 or 16?
I believe that she was 14 when she met him, and during many of those teen years, the relationship existed. Anyway, we filed suit in February of 2019. Counsel appeared on behalf of R. Kelly and litigated the case. Discovery was done. The court required.
We've read the briefs and we've read the record. So there are two arguments that, according to your opposition, you never responded to. True?
I think that we do respond to it.
Well, okay, then take the first one. Whether the trial court abused its discretion when it failed to use its equitable powers to prevent the unjust enrichment of the default judgment entered against Kelly, in this case, by granting the petition. Where was your argument to that?
Well, first, we make two arguments, Judge. We make arguments that the trial court's order should be affirmed because there was no record of the trial court's proceeding.
No, that's not my issue. You definitely, they talk about in their brief, and we just heard it in oral argument, that you did not respond. Where do you respond to that first argument? It's on page one of their reply. And we just went over with Mr. Zito again.
I think we respond to it in the body of Roman numeral two of our response.
Okay, and what's the response?
Well, that we say on that the defendant appellant does not and cannot establish that he has a meritorious defense. And we go on to explain that.
Well, isn't the statute of limitations a meritorious defense?
Well, our argument is that she ruled on those, that Judge Johnson ruled on a motion to dismiss, and the affirmative defenses were stricken.
So, motion to dismiss the affirmative defenses, correct?
No, I didn't file a motion to dismiss the affirmative
right.
defense.
Okay.
They filed a motion to dismiss under 2619, it right. was briefed and argued and the judge denied it. And that was the law of the case.
All right, but what about the motion? And then there was no affirmative defense raised in their amended complaint. I mean, their answer.
In their answer, I don't recall whether they filed an affirmative defense, but all I know is I never responded to one because one didn't exist. And the reality is many of the pleadings were problematic that were filed by R. Kelly's lawyers. The affirmative defense that may have been filed, as I recall, didn't have any factual support. You can't just say, the statute of limitations were violated. You have to plead affirmatively as a plaintiff would, and they did not do that. And you know, and counsel said the judge struck that. That's not really part of the record. So
wouldn't the 2619 19 issue be before us at this point if the trial judge, as a matter of law for all practical purposes, struck that issue? It wasn't appealable at the time, so why wouldn't it be before us right now?
Well, I think the only thing before you right now is the 214-01 petition and whether or not it was properly.
But in the 214-01 petition, the same issue is raised, statute of limitations. So your argument is that they can't raise that as a meritorious defense because the trial court has already decided that it's not a meritorious defense, or that the trial court has already struck that. So why can't it be raised now as a meritorious defense?
Well, not because only
otherwise, this puts us in a position where we're never able to review a trial court's decision regarding a 2619 motion.
But I don't think it's the appellate court is not reviewing anything that Judge Johnson did in this case. The review is just of Judge Flannery.
We realize that we're reviewing the 214-01. And in the 214-01, there's another allegation that they have a meritorious defense. And that meritorious defense is the statute of limitations. Your argument is that they don't get over that hurdle, and then you come back to Judge Johnson's order. Judge Johnson's order was not final and appealable. It could not be appealed until the case was resolved.
Not only do they have to have a meritorious defense, but they also, in order to prevail on a 214-01.
I understand they have to still do diligence, but we're right. Talking about a meritorious defense right now. Don't change the subject.
I'm just saying.
Fine. You don't have an answer for me. That's fine. But don't change the subject. Now you can go on and move on to the due diligence.
Well, Judge,
I'm willing to hear you.
Justice, to your point, our argument is that that was ruled on by Judge Johnson. She denied
it,
and the law of the case is set.
I heard you. Now you want to move on to the next issue. I'm willing to move on.
As far as due diligence, they had over a year. They only filed a 214-01 approximately a year later. In fact, my brief is incorrect because in the facts section, I think I say in September of 21, but it was in February of 21 Jordan and Zito filed the 214-01 petition. So it was over a year later. The attorney Nix had filed an appearance the day I got the judgment. He didn't show at the time my client and I were in the courthouse proving the matter up. He came later, and it was only after lunch, later on that afternoon, that I learned from the court that he had entered an appearance and an order had been entered ex parte. Mr. Nix is the entertainment lawyer for R. Kelly. He's been involved in lots of other litigation, both during the pandemic and prior to the pandemic, involving R. Kelly's litigated matters in Cook County. And not only did he file an appearance, but because he filed the appearance, I gave him constant notice of all of the post-judgment relief that was going on in front of Judge Hennigan that ended up before the appellate court on the issue that was pending in that case. It's been decided. Not only did Mr. Nix know about every single thing that was going on the post-judgment relief and didn't do anything, but then when he filed this, when he failed to file within 30 days, I sat back because of the pandemic. I sat back and waited that 30 days. And then that 30-day period was during the pandemic, and no one knew what was going on in March, April, and May. And then in May, the court system said that they were thinking of opening up June 1. And so I said, all right, well, I got to wait for that to happen. And that it still didn't open up, as you know. And so I waited until August of 2020 before doing anything for post-judgment relief. And R. Kelly had another default judgment that was entered against him that Nix knew about, and Mr. Zito was involved in trying to do a 1401 petition to vacate that, which was also denied. The fact is, Nix was along the ride for everything. Now, the reality is, Mr. Zito at no time ever asked for an evidentiary hearing. And I never had an opportunity to bring any kind of response to the second affidavit talking about this intimidation in their reply brief to my response that was in front of Judge Flannery. So I never had an opportunity to respond. At no time did I never asked for an evidentiary hearing, and Mr. Zito never asked for an evidentiary hearing. If he had asked for one, maybe the judge would have given him one, but he never asked for it. And the fact is, because this intimidation thing is all smoke and mirrors and lies, because not only have I never spoken to Mr. Nix regarding this case, he never answers the phone. His secretary never gives him messages. And my only correspondence with him is in emails. There was
none of this, what you're telling us now is in the record though, right?
Right. Well, they're bringing,
we can't take account of it.
I understand
what's important that. What's important is if you were before Judge Flannery, right? And that's what's before us, okay?
Beyond I understand. That.
Okay.
Well, I'm just speaking to some of the intimidation arguments that were made.
No, but that's not really, is that part of what we need to decide?
It isn't.
And why is it?
Because all you have to decide is whether there was a meritorious defense and whether they had due diligence, and they lacked both.
The Justice Walker's question. So the only supposed or alleged affirmative defense is the statute of limitations, right?
Correct.
Okay. So the question boils down to, do they get a hearing on that? Is that something that we should reverse so they have a hearing on that issue or not?
I think it's already been heard by Judge Johnson.
And you responded to Justice Walker, and you say that that is not part of what we, under what cases or what rule or statute are you relying?
I'm relying on the fact that it was the rule of the case. I don't have a specific case to cite, but the fact, Judge, is that that issue was not before the court at the time of the, at any time. And I think it'd be a mistake for the appellate court.
I don't understand that. We just talked about the fact that they made an argument on the 1401 that they had a meritorious defense of statute of limitations, okay? So wasn't that before Judge Flannery?
I think Judge Flannery denied their motion, and when he denied it, he discounted all of the arguments they were making because the judge did not find them to be credible or to be in any way pertinent to the fact that there should be a hearing on the meritorious defense, and for the appellate court to reverse.
Let me just slow down a second. If what you're saying then is, then the issue might turn on a little different issue, and that is, you're saying they want to have a hearing. Just Flannery did not have a hearing, right? So
they never asked for a hearing, Judge.
Okay, they never asked for a hearing. So for us to say that there should be a hearing now makes no sense, because they never asked for it, and because we don't have a record of what happened before Judge Flannery. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And there was an appearance before Judge Flannery.
That's correct.
Okay.
And because at the time Judge Flannery made his decision, he could deny the motion under the law pursuant to 214-01, not just because there wasn't a meritorious defense, because there was no due diligence. You have to have both. And if you lack one, there's no reason to even talk about the other. So it's our position on behalf of the appellee that the court should deny the 214-01 response and affirm the decision of the trial court and their denial of the 214-01 petition.
Is it in their reply? It says that instead the trial court struck the affirmative defense sua sponte at a case management hearing after Kelly filed a motion for leave to file his answer, attaching his answer, which included the statute of limitations affirmative defense. Is that correct?
It is not correct. What is correct is that the court continued motions of both parties until from the 28th, when they, once they filed their motion to withdraw, there was a hearing supposed to happen at that time on the 28th, but they didn't have the hearing on any of those motions. We had filed a motion for summary judgment. So not only did Judge Johnson default the defendant, she also granted my motion for summary judgment. And any other motions that were there were denied, were stricken. Any other motions were stricken. So she granted the motion for summary judgment, defaulted the defendant, struck all the other matters that were supposed to be before her had there been counsel there, and set the matter for prove up. She also, the prior week, that was on 2/25/20. On 1/28/20, when she granted the motion to withdraw, she entered the appropriate order, which indicated that they needed to give notice to R. Kelly pursuant to the statute. And if they didn't do it, that was just another mistake that they had made.
Any other questions? You can finish, please.
Judge, I'm asking for the court to affirm Judge Flannery's order denying the motion pursuant to 214-01. Thank you very much for your time and attention, Justices.
Mr. Zito?
Just a few things. Number one, and I think the most importantly, is that we did ask for an evidentiary hearing in our reply brief at the very end. We say, if the court determines the response does not create triable issues, this court should grant the petition as presented. If the court deems otherwise, it must conduct a full and fair evidentiary hearing to ascertain the truth.
Wait, you asked it in a reply brief, is that right?
The reply and support to our petition after their response. Because they,
a reply brief. But yeah. I'm saying you never moved. You're asking for the relief in a brief, first of all. Correct? Correct.
Yeah. Yes. Okay.
So there's no motion. And it's a reply brief to which the other side doesn't get a response to.
Your Honor, this is the reply to the petition. So what happened was what Airroom said was if the respondent contests facts in the petition, then the court should hold an evidentiary hearing. That's what Smith v. Airroom says.
Well, did you file a motion for an evidentiary hearing and set forth why there should be an evidentiary hearing? I'm not talking about a brief. A lot of things in a brief.
We did not file a motion, okay. Your Honor. We said. Based on the fact that they filed a response, we cited Airroom and in the response, and then we laid out the whole reply basically was laying out all of the contested issues of fact. And then what we say is, look, we don't think that these are real, true issues, but if the court feels that they are, we said the court should grant our petition, but if it thinks that there are triable issues based on the fact that they've contested several issues in our petition, then the court is obliged under Airroom to have an evidentiary hearing. So we didn't file a motion asking for it, but that was part of the relief that we asked for at the end of our brief, because we didn't know whether or not Ms. Williams was going to contest these issues or these facts. I'm sorry. Only then did we know. So we put it in our reply.
In your reply. Right. So
in our reply in support of the petition.
Your reply in support of the petition.
Yes.
Correct. Which means they don't get a chance. It's not that they responded, you replied. That's not a proper place, is it, for a motion or to make a request in a reply?
Well, what we were saying to the court is
What rule or statute, or if you have a case that says it, and Smith is not that case. But
what the Smith case says, if the facts...
I said, Smith's not that case. That wasn't the situation in this, a reply brief. What you're saying would change is my understanding of the whole Civil Procedure Act. Isn't it? I mean, where in the Civil Procedure Act does it say that that's an appropriate way to ask for a hearing?
Your Honor, I don't know. My understanding of what would happen here is that if we had what we claimed in our reply is that we had set forth facts to entitle us to relief under the statute. And then they responded and challenged those facts. And so what we said then in our reply brief was, well, this court needs to have an evidentiary hearing now.
And the court said no, because it didn't have an evidentiary hearing. We don't have a transcript. The court denied the motion. So we know what the answer is. The answer is no. On the other hand, the answer is no.
But the court didn't have a hearing at all.
It didn't have a hearing. You asked for a hearing. What right do you have to hear? Again, it was never briefed. It wasn't something that the other side was able to respond to. It's in the reply. It's kind of like you're saying, gotcha, because we put it in a reply, they have to have a hearing. Am I wrong?
Well, I don't know, Your Honor. The way that we looked at this is that we filed a petition that we thought set forth sufficient facts to grant us relief. They filed a challenge to those facts. And then we said, okay, we got to have a hearing. And the court not only didn't have an evidentiary hearing, it didn't have a hearing at all. It didn't have a hearing explaining its rationale.
Again, I asked you the question before. You said there's no rule. Do you know of the only thing you could point to?
I'm not aware of a rule.
Right. Okay.
So the other thing, I just wanted to clean up a few things. The Ms. Williams complaint says that she was 17 at the time of the abuse, and then of course, when she attains majority, it's not the alleged abuse anymore. And then the other thing with respect to the affirmative defense was filed the same day as the court struck the affirmative defense, and no pleadings were filed in response to that affirmative defense. And so what happened was after the hearing, the same day again, Abdullah Law filed an answer. It did not include the affirmative defense because the court had stricken it. And so that was the timeline of what happened.
So it must have been with prejudice if they didn't include it.
Your Honor, we don't believe it was with prejudice because
why would they include it in order to preserve it? Isn't that the rule?
Your Honor, we believe that because it was not stricken pursuant to a motion to strike or any kind of response to it whatsoever, that it wasn't stricken with prejudice. And we cite case law.
Where in the rules does it say that if there's no response, the court must have a hearing or can't enter an order? You're not saying that that's the law.
I'm not saying that that's the law.
So there doesn't have to be. And it doesn't even have to be a motion. Oral motions are made all the time.
Well, I think after the court struck it, they felt like they couldn't include it again.
However they thought, sometimes you have to do what you have to do.
Yeah. I understand, Your Honor. The other thing that I was going to say is with respect to the bystanders report, I want to make it clear to the court that we responded to the idea that we set forth three issues. And what happened was in her response, in her appellate response brief, Ms. Williams brought up a new issue. She didn't respond to two of her issues and instead brought up a new issue that said, we should have filed a bystanders report or a report of proceedings or an agreed statement of facts, which we tried to get with respect to the hearing on the petition. But there was no hearing on the petition, so there was no way to do that. And so we only, in our briefs, only addressed that. We didn't address anything else because that was the question that they presented in their issues. And so we didn't go beyond that for obvious reasons. The other thing is that with respect to due diligence, and this is the last point I would make, is that, the heirloom court says that because we have this in our brief, in our petition that says a guiding principle in the administration of section 214.01 relief is that the petition invokes the equitable powers of the court, which should prevent enforcement of default judgment when it would be unfair, unjust, or unconscionable. And then we set forth facts that we believed that to be the case. And then the court also says, because a 214.01 petition is addressed to those equitable powers, courts have not considered themselves strictly bound by precedent and where justice and good conscience may require it, a default judgment may be vacated, even though the requirement of due diligence has not been satisfied. And so what we were trying to say is, look, we've set forth a meritorious defense in detail here. And then if the court were to find that there wasn't due diligence, equity should prevail here and the court should grant the petition anyway. And so that was the issue that we put in our appellate brief that Ms. Williams never responded to. That was the first issue. And then, of course, the second one was that the court should have held an evidentiary hearing. And Ms. Williams declined to respond to either one of those issues in any way, shape, or form. And so that's where I would like to end, because I think that cleans up any responses that I had to Mr. Deutschman. So, and I would thank the court for your time and for listening to us today.
Well, you gave us a lot to think about. Both of you did an excellent job with your oral arguments, answered our questions. It wasn't easy, I understand. So please enjoy the afternoon. We'll take the case under advisement and we'll be ruling in the future.
Well, thank you very much.